This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. There are some jobs that never leave you, even long after you leave them. For example, being Secretary of Defense. Ash Carter served as secretary under President Obama from February 2015 until the end of that administration. He started at the Pentagon back in 1981 when Caspar Weinberger was secretary and Reagan was president. Former Secretary Jim Mattis spoke at the unveiling of Carter's portrait in the Pentagon. Mattis remembered seeing him at Stanford after Carter left the Pentagon and just after President Obama offered the top job.
I still recall you and I standing there on the sunlit campus as we bid farewell to one another, little knowing that one day we would shake hands again in Washington, D.C. You were on your way back to the Pentagon, and I began praying for you immediately. So it was once more into the fray for you. This time, you would be our secretary, a job for which fate or providence had well prepared you.
So what does Ash Carter think of his successor, Secretary Mattis? We'll get into that later in the hour, and we'll explore how he prepared for and did a job as enormous as protecting America. Carter is the author of a new memoir called Inside the Five-Sided Box, Lessons from a Lifetime of Leadership in the Pentagon. And he joins us from NPR in New York. Secretary Carter, welcome to 1A.
Thanks for having me, Joshua.
I wonder how you reflect on how you found yourself in the position of being defense secretary. Is it something you were kind of groomed for, thinking about throughout your trajectory at the Pentagon, or did it catch you by surprise?
Well, I certainly thought about the Secretary of Defense a lot because, as you noted, I started in 1981, and I had a continuous association with the Department of Defense, working for or in it all the way up until 2017. So I knew all the Secretaries of Defense. They knew me. I did what I could to help them and help the department during that entire time. It wasn't my dream the whole time to become Secretary of Defense, but it meant that since I occupied so many different positions, including the number three and then the number two and then the number one position in the Defense Department, that I certainly knew what it was like. In a sense, I knew what I was doing. I had a lot of preparation. But that's different from aspiration to it. I mean, let's remember that in our system, the president chooses the Secretary of Defense as someone whom he or she, if we ever she president, is comfortable with. And that won't always be someone who is as associated with the department as I was. But President Obama chose me, ultimately, and I was very pleased to serve in the role.
What exactly is in the purview of your job that maybe the average person might not think of?
Well, let's think about just the sheer scale of the thing, for starters. It's half of the federal budget. It is a place that has more employees than Amazon, McDonald's, Federal Express, Target, and GE combined. It does more R&D than Apple, Google, and Microsoft combined. It operates real property that if it were putting on one place would be as large as the state of Pennsylvania. So this is the world's largest enterprise. And people think of the Secretary of Defense, rightly, as somebody who helps the president decide what the policies are and then importantly makes plans for war and carries out war when that is necessary. And all that's true. And of course, war is the heart of what we do. But you're also the manager and leader of the world's largest enterprise by far.
So how do you do that job day to day without being just on the verge of peeing your pants into how big this job is? I mean, it's a gigantic responsibility. How do you just go through it without letting the augustness of it freak you out?
First of all, what grounds you always is the troops. When I would get sick of Washington, we'd get in an airplane and we'd go somewhere and talk to the troops. And that always would make me feel better about the mission. So I never got tired of it. And there's an inherent nobility in the mission of protecting our people and making a better world for our children, being part of something bigger than yourself. That is a really great feeling. So all that keeps you going, even when there are a lot of hassles. I'll tell you a story about the management versus the other parts of the job. Remember, the national security advisor at the time, who was Susan Rice, I called her up one day and said, Susan, you just sent me a binder full of material for a meeting with the president this afternoon. How am I supposed to read all this stuff? And she sort of wrote back, well, this is the most important part of your job. And I shot back to her and said, well, no, actually, because the president expects me to run half of his government. And he expects me not only to make decisions, but to carry out the decisions he makes. So it's kind of one part of my job, but it's not the only part of my job. And she, to her great credit, said, all right, I understand. So you have a very big job when you're doing Secretary of Defense, and you're doing three jobs, four jobs, compared to the two other cabinet secretaries.
With regards to that job, you write in your book that you had mixed feelings about accepting it when President Obama asked you. What were the mixed feelings driven by, and what helped you get past them?
Just the human things that, in this case, I had just moved to California, taken up a new life. I had left the department several months before as the number two. I didn't think I'd ever be back to the Department of Defense after that. And I was starting off to start another career in technology, which is my other side as a physicist. And so I would have to wrap up everything I was doing and come back to Washington and go through it again. I also wanted to talk to President Obama. And this is a caution for people who say, if the president calls you, you just say yes. Well, no, you don't. The president calls you, you say, well, I'd like to talk to you about it, or at least I want to think about it, because your duty as a cabinet secretary is to serve the president of the United States, and you have to have some reasonable idea that you can be helpful to him. And so I wanted to talk to even President Obama, whom I knew, about certain issues and just see if we were close enough that we wouldn't have a problem later on if I did become his Secretary of Defense. So you need to make sure. And I have said, with respect to the current president, that he doesn't seem to listen to his Secretary of Defense, so it wouldn't seem very productive to me to be the Secretary of Defense to him. And President Obama didn't always listen to me, but he listened to me enough of the time that I felt like I was being useful to him.
I want to talk to you more about the work of the Pentagon in a moment when we continue with former Secretary of Defense Ash Carter. Definitely want to talk about how you manage the finances of the world's largest enterprise, some of the other challenges that the Pentagon faces, and what the future for the Department of Defense might look like. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Babbel. Have you always wanted to speak a new language? Whether it's for travel, work, or brain training, Babbel's 10 to 15-minute lessons will get you speaking confidently in your new language. Choose from Spanish, French, and more. You'll learn through real-life dialogues, speech recognition, and interactive trainers. And Babbel's spaced repetition method actually makes you remember what you've learned. Download the app or go to Babbel, BABBEL.com, to try Babbel for free.
Blackface in a student yearbook, blackfishing on Instagram. You got Israel and anti-Semitism, you got Israel and colonialism. You have go-go music versus the gentrifiers. On Code Switch, we take the subtext of race and make it text. So come chop it up with us.
This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're speaking to former Defense Secretary Ash Carter. His new book is called Inside the Five-Sided Box, Lessons from a Lifetime of Leadership in the Pentagon. Let me ask you about one of the aspects of the Pentagon that seems to make the most political hay. You mentioned that you tried to keep the Pentagon out of politics as much as possible. It's the amount of money that goes into defense. You mentioned that it's half the federal government, based on the budget for sure. According to CNBC, the Pentagon seeking a 5% increase for the next fiscal year. That would bring its total apportionment to $718 billion. I can imagine, well, I don't have to imagine, there have been plenty of people over the years who have said, why does the Pentagon need that much money? Where do those funds go? If we took 5% out of the Pentagon, we could pay for college tuition for every student in the entire country, and we're spending all this money on the military and healthcare and roads and infrastructure and the environment. No, we're building more F-15s. What would you say to them? Why does the Pentagon need every penny that it's getting?
Well, the first thing I'd say is it's an absolutely fair question, and it's a good question. And to the point you made about defense spending and non-defense spending, I never, ever, nor would I now, have argued for defense spending at the expense of non-defense spending. I think this idea that it's a zero-sum game is really unbecoming a strong country.
Well, but it kind of is a zero-sum game, isn't it? I mean, you can't spend the same dollar twice.
Well, but here's the thing. The combined defense and non-defense dollars is only about 30% of the total budget. If you want to go looking where dollars are in the federal budget, you have to look at mandatory spending or entitlements, and you have to look at taxes and the deficit. The discretionary spending, what we're talking about, which is schools, roads, R&D, Homeland Security, intelligence, but also national defense, are the things that we all need to have done for us that we can only do collectively, and that's what our government is for. And I think that we are too parsimonious with our dollars in that regard. That is where people who have been afraid to take on those other parts of the federal budget have gone to get money. So I mean it when I say I don't think it should be that. I think the Defense Department, the defense budget, I'll get to that in a minute, and why I think that we need a Defense Department that is substantial, but why we can't waste that money. But I also believe in that a strong country depends on having R&D and having infrastructure and having an educated populace and all these other things. So It in my view, it's not a zero-sum game. It shouldn't be a zero-sum game. Now, with respect to defense, you say, why? First of all, these are very small differences from year to year. I know everybody makes a big deal out of a small increase or a small decrease. In practical terms, they have been a few percent here and there as gone from administration to administration or year to year. Why is it so big in the first place? There are a couple of reasons for that. One is that we pay our forces very well. Another one is that we have ballooning health care costs like everyone else does. Another is that we're a very high technology force. And so compared to forces that are conscription forces and so forth, our manpower bills, our health care bills are very expensive. We also, if you think about it, we are up against – as potential antagonists, China, Russia, Iran, Korea, terrorists, and maybe others or totally different things in the future. So we have a lot to invest in, whereas most of them are focused on us only and can focus all their dollars on them. Now, so I can justify a lot of the size of the defense budget. What I can't justify and won't justify is the waste of a single nickel of this. And this is something I did as the acquisition officer, the chief operating officer, and the chief executive officer of the Defense Department is fight waste. That you can't justify.
That's one of the things I wanted to ask you about, Secretary, because, you know, we hear these reports about, you know, $4.6 million on crab and lobster or $600 on a toilet seat. And, it obviously erodes trust in the system. You write about the Joint Strike Fighter program and the problems that arose from that. It's still more than a decade behind schedule, more than $200 billion over budget. I don't want to go through all the problems of the Pentagon because there's been plenty of reporting about the difficulty of just following the money there. But what did you see that could help explain why it's so difficult to follow the money and maybe get it how to follow the money through the Pentagon better? Why isn't that a higher mission for a mission-driven organization to not waste my money?
Oh, it was for me. And there's a lot we can do. Yes, and there are programs that are mismanaged. And you can't go to the American public and say what I was just saying about the size of the defense budget. And and the merits of having a defense budget that's big enough to protect the country and at the same time tolerate waste. So let's take the Joint Strike Fighter. You gave an example of when I came into office as the chief weapons buyer, that thing was years behind and double its budget and was in such disgrace that I didn't think it could survive, which would have been a problem because it was the tactical fighter aircraft of the future for three of our services. And the book details what I did to try to get some managerial control and succeed in getting some managerial control over this, over the Joint Strike Fighter. I talk about the aerial refueling tanker and so forth and the ways in which you can tighten up defense management and discipline the contracting process so that you don't have waste in the defense budget. I believe that's possible. I insisted on that from acquisition officials from me. And if you select really good acquisition officials and you back them up when they do the right thing and the courageous thing, you can get good results in defense. But I'm not going to apologize for a single nickel wasted. There's no apology that you can make for that. It's disgraceful. We don't expect it. We expect the troops to give their all, and we ought to give our all when it comes to mismanagement and waste in the Defense Department.
Well, then let me ask a dumb question. Why doesn't the Pentagon just use QuickBooks? I mean, it's not like there's no software for following money. Why can't the Pentagon, which is the nation's largest contractor, just contract with a company and say, install QuickBooks on every Defense Department computer around the world? I know that sounds reductive and a little third grade, but, you know, this is just arithmetic. No, why isn't it that easy?
We have, in a sense, that kind of capability today. It's not that we don't keep track of the money we spend. It's that a lot of the products we buy are one-of-a-kind things. Nobody else makes aircraft carriers. Nobody else makes nuclear weapons. Nobody else makes specialized vehicles for avoiding improvised explosive devices. So some of the things we do are sui generis. And if we were buying, but we also buy things that are purely commercially sourced, and we buy them in a commercial way. But a lot of things we have to do in a different way, and that's not to justify things when they're done in a wasted way. But we can't do everything like the commercial sector.
With regards to that, the president was elected in part due to a rising anger among many Americans over partisan gridlock. He vowed to run the U.S. government like a business. The acting Secretary of Defense, Patrick Shanahan, used to be the senior VP of supply chain and operations for Boeing. What are your thoughts on that, on running not the whole government, let me just stick to the Defense Department, about running the Pentagon more like a business?
Well, I think good management acumen is a good thing to have in a Secretary of Defense, and that was basically how I ended up as Secretary of Defense, is more on the managerial side. I certainly was not a political figure, and it's a good thing to have. I would, and you can get that in business. I would say that running a company is not the same as running the Department of Defense. So it's really important that you have some prior association with the department before you take over the top job. In the same way, I wouldn't have said that my being Secretary of Defense automatically qualified me to go run a major oil company or something like that if I had never been in that sector before. There's just a certain amount that you need to learn and master about a given field, no matter how talented you are. So I think it's important to have some managerial acumen, but it's also important to have some background and experience in defense. All these ingredients are important to a Secretary of Defense.
I want to talk more about our relationships with our allies and our adversaries when we continue with former Defense Secretary Ash Carter. Stay close.
Thank you.
Support also comes from NCR. Let's face it, as a small business owner, you wear so many hats every day, you rarely have time to focus on activities that drive profitability or bring in new customers. That's why you need a point of sale that does more. NCR Silver delivers simple-to-understand analysis and business-building tools like email marketing and loyalty, so you can get back to focusing on your customers. NCR Silver. Visit ncr.com/silver.
We're back with a new season of Rough Translation.
Yeah.
And this time, we are following people who break the rules.
I mean, lying is part of the business.
In my opinion, the best revenge against ISIS is to be humane.
Am I supposed to punch her?
Yeah.
New episodes every other Wednesday. Subscribe.
Back now to our conversation with former Defense Secretary Ash Carter. His new book is called Inside the Five-Sided Box. There's an acronym that I learned through prepping for this, which is CRICKT. C-R-I-K-T. China, Russia, Iran, North Korea, and terrorism. I imagine that those are the countries, the entities that pose the big threats to U.S. national security. A number of people have articulated on those various players in various ways. Give me a sense of how you would like to see us, if you were Defense Secretary today, right now, dealing with CRICKT, dealing with these five different kinds of threats. And is there one that you would take care of first?
Sure. Well, first of all, can I tell you the story of CRICKT?
Yes,
please. It's a great Pentagon story. Well, I used to talk all the time with my senior commanders. We would go through our war plans and our preparations. And I would always say, let's not make this too abstract. Let's talk, let's put the names to the names here. Who are the real problem children? China, Russia, Iran, North Korea, and terrorism. And I go through that list again and again and again and again. And one time I overheard in the hallway somebody talking about CRICKT. And then I heard it again in a meeting and somebody talked about CRICKT. So I turned to one of my assistants and said, what are these people talking about CRICKT? And he says, oh, that's your strategy. He said, you know, everybody was repeating it so often that they just turned it into the word CRICKT. So there you go. Just naming the parts becomes a strategy. And in the Pentagon, a strategy gets an acronym. And you ask, what do we do to prepare for all of them? Unfortunately, they're all a little bit different. China and Russia are high-end, that is, more demanding in terms of the level of technology, and both involve our nuclear powers, moreover, so that's important. They both have substantial land mass, and so they have a lot that's in common. But North Korea, say, is much smaller, and if it were only a matter of conventional war, would still be a serious problem, not because it's close to the United States, but because it's close to South Korea. At a war there, we would win. We would destroy North Korea's regime and North Korea's military, but because it's in such a densely urban area that the warfare takes place, it is a very grisly war. But then on top of that, North Korea has nuclear weapons, so that means you're dealing with a country with a strange government like that, that has just newly come into possession of nuclear weapons. That's a different kind of problem. Then you got Iran, which doesn't have nuclear weapons, but is right there in the Middle East and does a lot of stuff with proxies and third parties and Hezbollah and so forth.
The war in Yemen and that kind of thing.
Yeah. And then you got terror. So they're all different. And this is one of the problems that we have as the world's leading power is that if you go to a Chinese military briefing, it's all about the Americans. And if you go to a Russian military briefing, it's all about the Americans. You go to an American military briefing, it's about CRICKT, because we have to be concerned about all of them, and they're pretty much focused on us.
Soren wrote on our Facebook page, "We are the world's bully. The USA is the most hated slash feared nation in the world, not Iran, North Korea, or Cuba. As Americans, we tend to see ourselves as the quote-unquote good guys, but with our military posturing, endless wars, and neo-imperialism, don't we cause more chaos and violence than we prevent?" And Lori added, "Why hasn't anyone charged the U.S. with crimes against humanity? Where are the sanctions on the U.S.? Is everyone too afraid of the U.S. to do what is right?" Secretary?
Their spirited questions, and they're perfectly fair questions. But to the question, do we do more harm than good? I think empirically, the United States has done a lot more good than harm. Let me give you some examples. There's no other country that could have put together the military campaign, the training of local forces, the marshaling of allies to defeat ISIS than the United States. And do you really think ISIS didn't need to be defeated? This is a country that in 2015, a so-called country, this is a group of people who are crucifying people, who are enslaving women, who are subjugating whole populations. I don't think you can have that. I think somebody has to stick up for a civilized world. And the United States did that. I think that was a good thing. It's something I'm proud of. It was in our own country's interest. But there were other countries, particularly the people in the territories tyrannized by ISIS. But then next, you come to Turkey, you come to Europe and so forth, that suffered much more from ISIS-inspired terrorism than the United States did. But we did have it also in the United States. I think that was a good thing. Next, I'd say, how about preventing war in Europe for a generation? Without the United States, the Soviet Union, Stalin's Soviet Union, probably would have overrun Western Europe. Now, we've made mistakes along the lines, and we can all debate along the line, and we can all debate that particular instances. But I think on net, the record's pretty good. And as to the question of do we do it in a civilized way or not, which was the second question there, also a fair question. And I used to say as Secretary of Defense, and I meant it, that the United States took its values to the battlefield. And that meant U.S. law, international law, and the law of armed conflict. And we try to abide by that. And believe me, we work very hard. Again, we're not perfect. When we make mistakes and we do something wrong in an airstrike, we do an investigation. We report to you about that investigation. No other country is that candid about the mistakes it makes. Before I could propose something to the president to approve a strike or a hostage rescue or a war plan or something, lawyers went through it looking for just those things. And they'd say, this is not consistent with U.S. law or international law and so forth. And that wasn't the American way.
Before I let you go, Secretary Carter, I'm wondering if you miss it, if you miss being at the Pentagon, if you miss being the Secretary of Defense, or if you're ready to move on before we let you go.
Well, there's a little of both. I mean, I knew that you couldn't last forever, but I love the Department of Defense. I'll always be devoted to it. And I love the job. I felt like I knew what I was doing and that it was a noble calling to be working in this wonderful department. I'd say that to any young person now, thinking about military service or any other kind of public service, whether in the Defense Department or anywhere else. At the same time, you can't do it forever. That's not the way our system works. And so when I came out of the Defense Department, I said, well, I'm not going to hang around the Washington hoop like a lot of people do, or I'm not ready to go retire. Either I want to work on the other big thing other than protecting our people, which I think is the issue of our time. And that is the way technology is affecting our lives. And technology brings a lot of good things. And I'm a technologist. But we have to admit that technology can have a darker side as well. So digital technology's brought a lot of commerce and community, but it's also brought hatred and darkness and lies and other things. We have a bio revolution to come, an AI revolution to come. We have the whole question of technology's impact on jobs and people's sense of their own worth and ability to plot a future for themselves and their children. These are really big issues. And as a technologist, I think we need to find solutions to technology's dilemmas. That's my new crusade, and I find that as absorbing as I found defending our people. I like the idea of taking on something that's big and consequential and applying what I know to solving it. That's what got me into the defense and technology business in the first place, and I'm trying to follow that same star over another horizon now that I'm out of the Pentagon.
Ash Carter, the former Secretary of Defense from February 2015 until the end of the Obama administration. His new book is called Inside the Five-Sided Box, Lessons from a Lifetime of Leadership in the Pentagon. Secretary Carter, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for talking to us.
Thanks. Good to be with you. Thank you, Joshua.
This conversation was produced by Morgan Givens and edited by Miranda Fulmore. To learn more about them and the rest of the team, visit the1a.org/staff. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.